Hello, welcome, ladies and gentlemen. Here we are, the third installment of Whitley Penn's Energy Executive Profiles. Today we have David Ramsen Wood with us, and definitely one of our most entertaining clients, and happy to have him here. This is Nathan McGowan, the partner in charge of Whitley Penn's Houston office. And David, I know you are the energy man that needs no introduction, but why don't you give us a quick five-minute intro background on yourself?
Wow, it's a easy start. I usually have to type this in the morning, but I think mostly I'm known of late for the hashtag hot take of the day on LinkedIn. We worked with you guys at One Energy for a very long time and appreciated everything you did. So I am an engineer by background. You'll tell throughout the whole interview that I sound like an engineer, I act like an engineer, I dress like an engineer. So we'll learn about that. Been Anadarko guy, Enerplus guy, worked all the basins, originally from Canada, lots to talk about, and really excited to be here. Thanks for having me.
Good. So you said dress like an engineer, and for those viewers that can't see, but we're definitely going to post a photo, I kind of feel like you're from Bronx, New York, maybe a gangster. You have a pinky ring and a tracksuit covered in tigers?
Tigers, toucans, and a little gold stripe.
Tigers, and then some custom-made black leather boots with also tigers and gold tips. So you've got to tell us what's behind this outfit.
So it's today. It just felt like one of those days. It hangs in the closet, and with great power comes great responsibility. So when I put on the tracksuit, it's a different person comes out. I felt like I was gonna bring like my A game for you. So I went to the airport in Denver. I almost missed my flight. I ran through the airport wearing a tiger tracksuit.
But you're in a tracksuit, so running.
It was easier than you would think. But I did almost miss the flight, and usually I'm there 2 hours early, so that was tough. But so this suit came out of after we sold One Energy. I went to Vegas with some friends, and my friends are equally crazy. And this was on a mannequin right outside of our hotel. It has a gold embroidering on the side. Little tiger, little toucan, and they said, like, if we're going out tonight, you are wearing that. And so, needless to say, being the engineer that I am, a little introverted, we walked into the store. I put my credit card down. Thank God it was only $180, but it is the best $100. I had to act like a boss, right? So I slammed the credit card down. I'm like, I'm taking the tiger suit. And he's like, yes, you are. But it was fortunately only $180. It looks like it could be $3,000 for all.
I was gonna say it's so eccentric.
It could be a three. It's not obscene. So I put it on, and even in Vegas, they would walk three or four strides behind me because they wanted to see the reactions. And the reactions, the heads were turning. So we went out, had dinner, went to the club. I may have done a piano bar dance off. That was to Eye of the Tiger. And at that point, the entourage was born. We ended up with about 20 people. We had a fake names, fake business. We just sold our retirement home business. I can tell you about it if you want.
Maple syrup conglomerate?
Yeah, maple syrup. Vandalay Industries, importer and exporter. So that's where the tiger suit came from. Bottle service Hakkasan with a bouncer. All comped all night. So when I bring it out, crazy stuff happens. So I might wear it tomorrow at the keynote speech.
So you got to tell me about the pinky ring, which I think is a pretty cool story. A little more serious, but tell us about the pinky ring and why you're wearing it.
Yeah, so all Canadian engineers, there was a bridge that collapsed in Quebec in the 30s, I think. We all don't actually know the story, but we know it was an iron bridge. It collapsed because of bad design. And so all Canadian engineers get a pinky ring, which is supposed to symbolize the importance of your work. You wear it on your working hand. And so, and when you stop practicing, you have to turn it in. And so the cool thing was mine in particular, when my dad stopped being an engineer, he's the reason I went to be an engineer. He gave me his ring. So he got this ring, I think in about 1969, if my math is correct. And so it's, about a 50-year-old engineering ring, and I wear the one that my dad has.
That's awesome. And so what are the odds of that third generation getting that ring? You got any engineers below you?
I have a 15 and 13-year-old. I think the younger one either wants to play in the NHL or be a lawyer, and I think the older one wants to be a professional golfer or a hot take of the day guy on LinkedIn. So, I mean, maybe he'll go into engineering, but I'm not holding my breath.
Well, I mean, if nothing else, maybe you passed down that LinkedIn profile.
Exactly. I have guest writing all the time.
That's right. Okay, so, you know, many of our listeners probably do know who you are and a little more about your background, but for those that don't, you know, where'd you grow up? Give us a little background on that.
So I grew up, I was born in New York, I grew up in Calgary, so hence my dual citizenship. My dad worked for Exxon and sort of was in the major downturn of the 80s, so he was at Dome when they went bankrupt, so... you know, flash forward to 2019 and the same state of the oil and gas industry, I think, really reflects the 80s. So I always wanted to go into oil and gas, but grew up in Calgary, have a younger sister. She's in oil and gas as well. My brother-in-law is in oil and gas. My father-in-law, he passed away, but he was in oil and gas. So, like, my sister-in-law is in oil and gas. My brother-in-law is in oil and gas. So our whole family was oil and gas. I started out of school with Anadarko after an internship with Canadian Hunter, which became ConocoPhillips.
So before you go into that, yeah. So you said your dad was there when they went bankrupt. Seeing your dad go through any of that, did that cause, do you remember that? Do you remember going through those tough times?
And
that didn't cause you to think, man, I don't want to do this?
No, it didn't connect with me at the time, but so I do remember that Dome went bankrupt. The irony is my father-in-law was CFO of Dome at the time. And my father was the VP of marketing. And so marketing and CFOs always get, like, really angry at each other. So they were known for hating each other. And then I married his daughter. So that was always kind of entertaining to us. But, no, I mean, I remember we were going to be transferred to Chicago when Amoco at the time bought Dome out of bankruptcy. And my dad went a different way. He ended up retiring, and I grew really close with him because he was there my whole high school time. But it just never dawned on me. I always wanted to go into oil and gas. I've loved this industry since the first time I saw it. My dad and I bonded over it when I was a kid, and I'm just so blessed, to be honest, to get to work here, and the people that I meet in this are amazing.
And you went to college in Canada. But truth or fiction, you had a field hockey scholarship at Princeton?
So I was a field hockey. So, I mean, all Canadians obviously play hockey, but my thing was squash. And I was recruited to go to Trinity College in Hartford, which I went on a campus visit. And if you've ever been to Hartford and you've been to Trinity, you would know why I didn't go there. I mean, plus it's a liberal arts school, so that's never good. And then I was recruited to go to Princeton, but ultimately the tuition didn't make sense. So I stayed in Calgary. I went to University of Calgary, got my engineering degree with a focus on oil and gas, and then did an internship and started out of school with Anadarko.
And so you're going to Anadarko, and at what point, you know, you work for this massive company, you're saying, no, you know what, I'm gonna go off and do my own thing. I'm gonna go private equity. I'm gonna go try to build. You know, I don't want to be one of, you know, 2,000 or whatever the employee count was at the time.
So I was actually the opposite guy. I almost didn't get hired at Anadarko because I was not your typical engineer, and they didn't think I would stay. And as it turned out, of all the people that started with me, there was only one other in our big sort of graduation class that stayed. I always wanted to stay at Anadarko, to be honest. I loved the big sandbox. I loved everything they did. At one point, I offered to convert my defined contribution benefit or pension plan into the defined benefit because I was like, I'm never going to quit. Like, I'm a lifer, which surprised the hell out of people. They always thought I wanted to do it. So, I mean, I describe myself a little bit as an accidental entrepreneur. And in 2006, the story of how I ended up in Denver and how I ended up with my MBA is kind of crazy. And it's sort of where, and I think the interview will go there, but I was interviewing to go to an investment bank. Because my change was, you know, I didn't think Anadarko was moving fast enough. There were a whole bunch of people I would have fired. We had too many people that weren't doing a real job. They were being overpaid, underworked. I didn't like our asset. I thought we could have done better. And clearly I was 5 years out of school, so I knew what I was doing. And so I was interviewing with an investment bank in Calgary. And as I was walking back from the interview, I ran into the president of Anadarko Canada in the line at Subway. And with his Texas little drawl and his little mustache, he goes, David, how you doing? And I'm like, you know, to be honest, Mike, I'm not actually doing that great. I was at an interview. I think there's a lot of things we could change at the company. And in fact, here's a list of the 10 things that I wrote down as the reasons I were leaving. I'm just going to read them to you. He goes, David, you know, we're in line at Subway. So maybe you should make an appointment with my secretary and we'll meet on this tomorrow. And so I'll stop with the accents because I'm not really good at them. But that's how I remember the story, and he sounded exactly like that.
I got some Canadian
like
ones
that.
Later, so it's okay.
And so anyway, so we set up a meeting, and I actually, he allowed me to walk him through a PowerPoint of all the things I would change. And so he said, well, I really don't think you should take the job, but you let me know. And so I thought about it, and I decided not to take the job. And he said, that's cool, because Anadarko's buying Kerr McGee, we're buying Western Gas, we're closing the Calgary office, we're selling it, we want to pay for your MBA, we want to move you to Denver, and you're going to be on the management team with me. And so I was about to, and in fact, I verbally accepted the job, and then I went over and unaccepted after that. And so, like, you think about the changes in your life and how different it would have been. At the end of the day, I would not have been comfortable reporting on where the bus is going, although my hot take of the day does tend to be more analyst reporty than driving the bus. But that's how I ended up in Denver. And so I moved in 2006, and I ended up on the leadership team at Anadarko with a new office, new city. My family was in Canada. I was commuting every week. I had a young kid and a pregnant wife who was living in the basement with her parents. And that's how I got to the Denver.
And so when you think about that time on the family side, the wife must not have loved the traveling.
No, right? Like everyone, I was an asshole. This is an accounting podcast, so I probably can't swear, so you'll have to bleep that out. But I valued my career, and I'd watch my father-in-law and I watched my dad do it, and this was the 80s, and like there was a badge of honor to bring your briefcase home. There were no computers, obviously, so the carbon footprint was a lot smaller than kids today. We can talk about that, but you know, all you did was work. All you cared about was work. You lived for work, and I wanted to be just like my father-in-law, my father. And so I came home after I was offered the job in Denver, and I said to my wife, I'm moving to Denver. You can come if you want. So not great. Took probably 6 years maybe to get over that. But so, you know, and again, we can talk about how, you know, at the end of the day, the things that I did between 2006 and 2012 to advance my career are not the things that have made me successful today. The lessons I learned were, but all of the things that I did to put my career first. I remember getting invited when I got to Denver to go to a Santana concert, and it was my grandmother-in-law's 90th birthday away. Like, we were going to fly as a family and go to this, and I was like, I can't go because I'm getting invited to a Santana conference or concert, and that'll impact my career. Which I look back on now, and I just, so people who make decisions like that, it's just, it's a long road, and no one really gives a shit whether you go to the Santana concert or not, because you end up in the same place regardless of what you do. So,
and I can, you know, I have had those moments in my career myself, and so I know what you're saying there, and I'm sure my wife would mention. You think, I'm just going to work harder than anybody else, and that will get me where I need to go, and everything else will just work out, right?
Yeah.
And then you wake up, and you're like, wait a minute.
Well, I mean, and I'm going to jump ahead of the question, because I like to, like, control the narrative on this one, but, you know, like, I wrote a book in 2012 after I was fired, and it was, you know, up until that point in my career, I thought I was the best. I thought I could have run any company. I thought that was infallible, and I was the smartest, and all those things. And for me, getting fired was sort of like the, oh my God, I am not that important. And to reintroduce myself to my family, who I'd really neglected, and I know, you know, my wife was 10 days away from, like, moving back to Canada. And so the timing of that was really big. And, you know, I went from 300 emails a day, 50 phone calls. We were running 4 rigs in the Bakken. I had put the Enerplus position together for them, 75,000 acres. Like, I was running the company, but I wasn't. And then I wasn't. And I had, like, literally no life outside of it. And so to process it, I was so upset that I started writing this book that's called What the F is Wrong with Everybody Else? What They Didn't Teach You in Business School. And it really started out as a joke. Like, it was supposed to be like it was like chapter one is losing weight, eat less, exercise more. Yes, it is that easy. And that was the whole book. But then I was fired, and I had literally nothing to do. And I probably wrote 200 pages in the next, you know, 10 days. And then I added another couple hundred over the next couple of years. And it was that journey and that book and that experience that made me, like, recalibrate my life in terms of what was actually important. And it is the sole reason why I ended up having the success I had. I had all the skills before, but I didn't have the understanding of how to balance with people. So so that's that.
And you know, we won't really touch much on One Energy, Franklin Mountain. You know, we had Brandon on a few episodes, and we went a little more detail in there. But I got to get to hot take of the day. You know, this is probably going to be a little bit of your legacy. I mean, you've clearly had success in business, which is great, and that will help you and your family for you know, many years to come. But hot takes in the day. I mean, tell us about how did that evolve? You know, how did you think of that? How else did you say, you know what, every day I'm going to do this, and it's going to, you know, what is that going to turn into? I mean, give us the thought process there.
So we had been for sale at One Energy really since 2017 when we launched the process, and then ultimately we sold our last asset to Franklin Mountain, and they bought the Fed sale as well, so I was in a bit of an intermediary period. I'd wanted to get the book published. Now for all those aspiring authors out there, like the story of my book doesn't work if you don't have success at the end. So I'd always kind of waited for the success. And when we sold One Energy, I was like, okay, this seems like a good time to publish it, because the book, you know, as much of an asshole as some of you out there think that I am. And the comment I get a lot is when they meet me, they're like, I really thought you were going to be mean. But the book is really a self-reflective journey. And so I wanted to publish it. So I talked to a publisher and they said, do you have a link, like a social media following? I'm like, I hate social media. I don't like Facebook. I don't like Twitter. I'm not on them. I have this LinkedIn account I haven't logged into for 5 years. And they were like, well, you know, if you have a following, it's easier to publish a book because people are writing books every day. And so I joined Twitter and I started like just randomly posting things on LinkedIn. And it was about rig counts and oil price, and it was probably around like November
and 17?
Of 18. It was after we sold One Energy. And so obviously the market was cratering, oil price was cratering, people were cratering, and I wrote just like a total throwaway. It was, I won't mention the names here, but it was, dear operator A, B, and C, please shut down your friggin' rigs. You are literally killing the industry by growing your production. And then it went into a whole analysis about DUCs and half-cycle returns and finished this thing, and I felt really proud. So I hit send. And then one of Brandon, who was on here before, one of his buddies who I know in passing, called Brandon and said, hey, tell Ramston Wood nobody gives a shit about his hot take of the day and that he should stop writing open letters that no one's going to listen to. And so like anybody, I obviously said, F you. And I added a hashtag, and the next day, since he was a banker, I wrote the following, which was like, dear unemployed people on LinkedIn, please immediately change your profile from unemployed to banker or investor, because in both cases, you're not actually doing anything all day, but it makes you sound a lot better and most like people in New York. Hashtag hot take of the day. And then I decided from that day on I would post once a day every day,
and so that was in November.
That was in November of 18. So I've done it.
So you're almost on your year.
I'm almost up to a year. Yeah. So anyway, I say this about the bumping into Mike and ending up where we were. The partnership with Leo and Brandon was also totally random. Like, your career isn't a ladder where you have this climb where you're going to be like entry level and then you're a manager and then you're a VP and then you're a C and then you're a partner, and it's like this career ladder. It's like a river and you just can't plan it because you don't know what's coming, and all you can do is make the best of it where you are. So the hot take was literally zero planned, and the first post I ever did had like 900 views in 3 months, and now I'm getting like 30,000 views a day.
Wow.
And I think it's because it's transparent, it's honest. People can disagree with me. I want to have conversation and discussion, but I am, if anything, I'm honest to a fault.
And I will say, I mean, it's not because I knew you before, but literally if you're in the demographic of like 30 to 45 and you're in the energy industry, whether you're in it as an engineer or you do accounting for people, you know, like myself, it's funny, like everyone knows hot take of the day, and it's this kind of a, you know, small niche, but that's growing and growing, and now starting to get recognition, you know, in the entire industry. And it's funny how quickly it took off, because I remember when I had dinner with you in Denver, and then, you know, I said, oh, I'll follow this and I'll check it out, and then next thing you know, it's like everyone's like, do you see his hot take of the day? So at what point did you know, realize, quote unquote, I'm LinkedIn famous?
Well, my mother had to follow me because her friends were asking about it in Calgary. So she had me help her with her LinkedIn profile and join. So that was a big one. I think also just I was at some conferences this summer and people would like come up and chat and talk, and you'd talk for like 3 or 4 minutes and then right at the end they'd say, "Hey, by the way, I love your hot take of the day." And you sort of, you know, I'm not this. Nobody knew who we were, and it's hilarious that a lot of people think I'm like a professional blogger and that I don't have a real oil and gas job. And the reason that, you know, honestly, the One Energy success was a great success and I feel so blessed for what it was. But like, if I should be famous, it should be for that, not for the hot take of the day. But the hot take has far surpassed it. And to be honest, it's the thing I probably enjoy the most other than the people I work with.
I mean, you're only months away from asking for autographs and stuff, right?
No, I don't think so. My kids roll their eyes a lot at me, so that kind of keeps it real.
No, it's so – I mean, this is such a small world, and I will say, I mean, energy in terms of dollars and everything, it's massive, right? But in terms of everyone knows each other, you're only a few degrees of separation. People are very careful with their reputation, not upsetting people, don't rock the boat. So did you know, have any fears, man, I'm going out some people here or some companies, is this going to cause any repercussions?
I mean, yes and no. I would say that, The intent was to cause discussion, and I think our industry is in crisis, and I don't think people are facing it, and I don't think people... I'm not saying anything that everyone wasn't saying already, and so while I may be pissing off 2 or 3 people on a day, that the conversation I thought was important enough to share, and, you know, I love the FinTwit guys, as we talked about before this. I just rejoined Twitter after a 9-month hiatus where I was in rebellion, and... It's my name and it's my reputation, and I stand behind the things I say, and people can DM me and they can comment on me and they can troll me, and they know who it is. It's not an anonymous figure, and I think that these are issues that people need to talk about to understand where our industry's headed, so no one's blindsided by it. So I've taken it up more as like a mantle than I have about anything else. So yes, are there some people who will like talk to me and say, "Hey, please don't write about this tomorrow"? For sure. Are there some people who, you know, I get some drunk texts from guys late at night? It's always guys, and it's always like 11:50, and they're like, "You're an idiot." There was one I actually posted on it, and he's like, "Who made you the expert? You're an idiot. You can't even hold down a job." And like, I wake up the next morning, and this was a drunk text from some dude that obviously had issues. But I think it's important enough to say. I think it's important enough to talk about. So until I stop doing it, I'm gonna keep fighting the good fight.
Well, I mean, your posts are fact-based, right? And you clearly put some thought and analysis in them, and you're not just spitting out something that comes to your head. And so there's information behind it, and you're doing it with your name. There's a lot of other people doing it out there, and parody accounts or whatever, so they can't be, have the repercussions of it. But with all that said, and all these great tweets and great information, what is your most popular tweet, and how surprising was that? Or not tweet, your post.
The post. So the most shocking one was actually a throwaway one, and it was sort of speaking to managers that like to pretend like they're super busy all the day, and all they do is meetings. And I'm sorry, I'm just not a meeting guy. I don't believe in meetings. If you've hired the right team and you actually understand what your business is, you don't need to meet with your team for them to tell you what they're working on. If they have a problem, I will snap my fingers and solve it to the best of my ability. But like, we don't need to meet about that shit. And so what I also see is that at 10:30 at night, people would like not be working all day, and then they would go and empty their inbox from everything that gathered up at 10:30 at night. And at the time, my mom had just been diagnosed with breast cancer, and I was emailing her. Now, I'm also on my phone all the time, so this is not an excuse, but in this particular case, I truly was emailing my mom. And this email came in with like this request, and I need this and I need that, and it was to the team. And when a senior person emails someone at 10:30 at night, and if they happen to be, this is not a senior person I work with, by the way, just to be clear, so no one can worry about it. But when a senior person emails somebody that is junior to them, that junior person is going to feel stress if they happen to be on their phone. And if they wake up to that email, they're going to feel like they're behind. And so my point was, please stop sending emails at 10:30 at night. There is actually a feature next in Outlook that allows it to be delayed until the next morning when someone can actually deal with it. If you need it, call me. If you don't, stop being so freaking selfish. And so that post got 550,000 views. And the first day it had 100,000 views. And I was like, I had absolutely no idea that that was going to do it. And it sparked all forms of commentary. And they're like, you're a COO. Why can't you take emails? And then there's like, you go girl. And there's like, there's all the things. And so I'm like, wow, I just would never have seen that post go viral. And so the next day, I'm like, well, I'm going to blow up the internet with this one. Here's email etiquette part two, and it had like 3,000 views. So you never know. You never know. So that one, and then when Elizabeth Warren tweeted that on the first day of her presidency, if she gets in, that she would put an executive order to ban fracking, I felt like I had to weigh in because it is just so factually ridiculous that if you were to ban fracking on day one, that 67% of the natural gas produced in this country is produced from fracking, and that 8 million barrels a day comes from oil shale plays with a base decline of 30%. So if you shut down for 5 months fracking, you would end up declining 2 million barrels a day. You would drive oil prices to 85. We would still need all of Saudi oil, which does not have the regulations or the cleanliness we have. Natural gas wouldn't power. Like, you would basically break the economy, and it was just an illogical, uneducated, very frustrating tweet. That one got 200,000 views in a week.
Well, I like how you just make them, you humanize them, you throw in some quirky stuff, whether it's about a Netflix show or whatever.
Mm-hmm.
The one where clearly you've seen Hamilton.
Yes,
and, the song. Yeah, the song. That one was brilliant.
The song was fun. Yeah,
year, and. So how much time do you put into some of these? I mean, you're doing them once a day. Clearly, you have a thought process. You have analysis. I mean, how many research? Who's on your research team here? Is it you and Brandon White?
No, so Brandon. I mean, in fairness, I get a lot of DMs, and I'm really, like, I've met a lot of new people, and people suggest topics, or they send clips, or I'll be chatting with someone, and someone will say something interesting that I'll write down and try and research. I try and limit my post to 30 minutes a day, and I almost always do it the night before. So I have a quote that I said, write drunk, edit sober. And that came up because somebody had trolled me, and I wrote like a really big response that was like really pretty fiery. And then I read it the next morning, and I just deleted it. And my post that day was, this post used to be longer, write drunk, edit sober. And so I do try and write all the posts the night before. I try and spend 30 minutes. I do try and research sort of over the course of like weeks if I'm thinking about something. And then they just sort of flow. I've moved into series now because 1,300 characters on LinkedIn isn't quite enough. And so I've tried to pick themes, whether it's leverage of companies. Previously it was the beating series. Right now we're talking about energy policy in the U.S., just there are some things I think need more in depth, and we can talk about how news to me is no longer valid and why I think podcasts are so great. But that's what I do, and I just try and spark conversation, spark thought, and I don't try and be the expert on everything, and hope people weigh in. And a lot of people have corrected some things I've said, and people have some comments, and I value everything. So
How I do it. I'm predicting literally you could go to some of these campuses, offer a free internship if you do research, give them some publicity on your posts, and next thing you know, those guys are hired two years later.
Yeah,
so,
no, for sure. I mean, I think
you're gonna have a research team.
2020 is gonna be interesting. Like when with politics and the environment, the reason it went off Twitter in part, other than the robo tweets and fake news and all this other stuff, was it was just so political, and you were self-sourcing into it, and you were fighting over random stuff. Whereas LinkedIn, in 1,300 characters, you can at least propose a view, propose facts, and have a discussion, and people have to use their real names. So, you know, I know the FinTwit guys, I just joined Twitter, and the first thing was like, Ramsden Wood, go on Twitter, get rid of LinkedIn. But there's just not enough characters, and people are anonymous. So,
but there's more funny memes.
Yeah, there are funny memes, and now I'm on, so if you want to DM me as an anonymous person, you can now come to my Twitter account, and we can have a conversation. But generally, I like what LinkedIn is. I'm clearly using it differently than most people.
Well, it's fun because
I enjoy it.
I mean, you see people try to get Instagram famous, whatever, but like you're one of the legitimate first ones making the LinkedIn famous, I know. More business spin on it.
I will say one of my favorite, because I love Brandon White. I think he's great. I talk about him all the time. And we were out for dinner last week when I was down here. And somebody leaned over and he goes, "Hey, are you the hot take of the day guy?" And Brandon was just like, "Oh, come on, you gotta be kidding me." But you know, Brandon's very supportive of it too, and he gives me a lot of the ideas that I end up researching. And so, anyway, I try and be a voice for the industry.
Well, okay, so moving more to industry, you know, if you had your crystal ball and you're looking at private equity upstream space, you know, what is the profitable strategy now in the private equity pack upstream space?
I mean, I would say in private equity, obviously. So I'm going to differentiate public and private. And I want to say first, shale is not a Ponzi scheme. It is not. The wells are great. The wells are economic. There are a lot of wells that are great. Now, there are some companies drilling some wells that they shouldn't be drilling. But the core business, the good wells work. What I would say is in public companies, that in 2012 to 2014, when the rest of the world economy was blowing up and interest rates were low, oil and gas companies had access to free capital and banks were giving it to them. So they levered up their balance sheets, they bought resource plays, they expected $100 to $140 a barrel, they built entire business models on that, and then oil went to $30. And so the crisis of public companies and the crisis that we have in our energy industry right now is a crisis of balance sheets, it's not a crisis of cost. For private equity, the model has been to buy land in front of slower moving public companies, prove up the concept in a time when prices were rising and resource plays weren't fully exploited, and then sell it to public companies in a bigger package. I would say every acre that's worth owning in the United States and in Canada is already owned. And so at this point, the private equity game needs to be private capital, which buys assets that it likes, that it can consolidate, manage G&A, get a good rate of return and keep leverage very, very low. And where you use leverage, you use hedging. And it needs to be $1 billion, $2 billion, $5 billion commitments from private equity firms that don't expect 20% rates of return. So you're going to pension funds, you're going to a different source of capital because the whole buy, lease, flip, sell with one well doesn't work. Now, there are some teams that have assets that I think are phenomenal, and those teams have realized that the way that they can make money is to drill their returns. So if you like at $50 oil, if you like 2-mile laterals, co-development, stacked play, Permian, whatever it is, parent-child relationships, and you go and hedge the shit out of it, and then go drill the shit out of it, you are going to be able to make your returns, and I think that those are the two models that work in private equity. In public companies, finance people, and I'll use Brandon. Brandon has sort of made me aware that like finance people sometimes feel like in a technical person's game that they are sort of always at the side. I think that now is the time for finance people to be able to step in and actually make a difference, because the leverage that are built into these companies and the balance sheets and debt holders who do not want to have their debt go below 100 cents on the dollar are rejecting it, and shareholders are the ones who are going to end up holding the bag. You need management teams and public companies to have the debt holders and shareholders come together and say, our capital structure is wrong. We're not going to go through bankruptcy. We're going to convert a whole bunch of debt into equity, and we're going to make this work. So I think finance people have a huge role in that. And so I bifurcate private versus public, but that's the state of our industry right now.
And touch on specifically mineral in that kind of opportunity. You've seen a lot of mineral only or new funds, you know, what's your thought on that strategy and how to make it, you know, work?
I mean, I think it works, but again, if you bought minerals in 2016, you were early to the game. And when I went to NAEP this year, it was one of the times my hot takes kind of went from like 3,000 views a day to maybe 12. And it was because I said, you don't really need to go to the conference, the NAEP conference, just go to the Four Seasons bar and you can visit with everyone you want to visit with, and they're drunk, so they tell you more. And at the time, I said water is the new oil, because there was no upstream assets that were working, there was no market to sell into, and private equity still had billions of dollars to deploy, and they saw water as an issue, in particular in the Delaware Basin. The amount of money that went to the water business has driven water costs down from 3x what it was to what it is today, and has now made the water business not a good business. because our industry is so efficient and so entrepreneurial and so capital intensive, you can just move things. So minerals, if you bought them in 2016, you're doing great. If you're starting a mineral company now, I don't like your chances. If you started a midstream company in 2016, good. If you started one now, I don't like your chances, because our industry can grind returns away. And at the core, you need a good asset that works economically and that you support the business to. So I'm not fired up about any particular business model right now. I think we're in the worst time since 1986 when my dad's company went bankrupt.
And, you know, one more, you know, your current hot take, peak oil.
Peak oil.
So
I love that topic.
When did you decide, you know what, peak oil? Who was the guy that wrote the original peak oil book?
It was Dr. Hubbard. I think it was a Dr. Hubbard. But peak oil, like 1966 theory, and he was right. And so a lot of the guys on LinkedIn, I will say, and I will answer that question, I'm not going to be a politician, but conventional oil worked until it didn't. And the reason that we went deeper and to resource plays and horizontally was because there was no conventional plays that a public company could own back in the 80s and 90s when we were declining. That's in part with the oil crisis why we shut down. The resource boom is what led to, from 2005 to 2019, why oil and gas worked again, when before 2005 we weren't that really exciting an industry, right? And so the peak oil thing, I did not plan on doing it. I do all my own work, and I always recommend this. Like, it's all well and good to have a team that does a lot of work, but in the key strategic decisions, the person making the decision and ultimately accountable for that decision needs to do the work. And I was looking at U.S. production from the EIA. It's all public. Everyone can see it. December 2018's production was 12.1 million barrels. July 2018 production, offsetting for the Gulf of Mexico hurricanes, was 12.1. At the same time, if you look at the DUC count, which I don't care about the DUCs and whether they work or whether they don't, I look at it as a rate of drilling and completions. We were completing wells 20% faster than we have ever completed wells in the United States going back to 2014. When you look at the lengths of wells, every well was being drilled 20% longer. So we were drilling 20% more wells, we were completing 20% more wells, we were going 20% longer, and production did not grow in spite of putting billions of dollars in the ground. So I looked at that data and then looked at the decline profile, and I was like, we are at peak oil. I didn't want it to be peak oil, but it just, that was the conclusion, and you couldn't come to another conclusion. I posted on LinkedIn, and I have not had anyone show me data that shows that I'm wrong. Now, if I'm wrong, we'll be able to point to, you know, this happened and the data was wrong and blah, blah, blah. But the reason peak oil is important is because the only way oil and gas companies have worked in the last 10 years is when price goes up and when you grow production. And growing production is important to grow your way out of debt, because guys have put so much debt on these assets to lever their returns. If you don't grow production, you can't grow your EBITDA, which means your debt to EBITDA will not fall. So when you combine the fact that production is not physically possible to grow in our industry with the fact that oil has been 50 for the last year, price ain't saving anybody and nobody's growing, which means debt to EBITDA is going to spiral out of control, which is going to lead to way more bankruptcies in 2020. That's just the facts. And so the reason I posted on it is because I think it's important for people to realize that $100 oil isn't happening again anytime soon, and a lot of companies are going to go bankrupt before we get to a healthy state.
So
aren't I uplifting? This is what I love. I love, like, I'm bringing my message of joy and splendor around North America these days.
So why not peak oil too book and be the next
I look, my goal is not to monetize the hot takes of the day, and I think that's why they work. I'm not doing it to advertise. I'm not doing it to become famous. I'm doing it because I'm trying to be truthful, and I want people to argue. Like, my favorite book, for those who follow me on LinkedIn, or my favorite movie, is The Big Short. And like, look, those guys were super smart. They saw the housing crash come. They made money. I have not figured out how to make money in public companies on peak oil and the balance sheets other than to start a short fund. But it's just what I see and it's what I think. And I think by January of next year, people are going to realize the U.S. is not energy independent. And that is going to change the discussion of energy in this country, so that fossil fuels aren't the bad, you're causing climate change, stop driving, oil and gas is bad. And it's going to change to, we can't rely on Middle Eastern countries to provide us our fuel. we need a new solution. We need a new grid. We need new power, and fossil fuels are part of that solution. That, to me, is the win, and that's what I want people to transition to. And any politician that wants to have a debate about this at any time, here's a face that you can yell at. You can DM me. You can email me. Let's talk about energy policy in the United States, and I'm happy to take your call any day of the week.
Well, so now onto the fun, personal side.
All right.
20 questions, speed
Done.
Round.
Let's do it.
He has not seen these questions, so has not prepared. First one, this is a phone a friend question from Mr. Brandon White. Who do you think you look more like, Prince Harry or Carson Wentz?
I got to go Carson Wentz. I think Prince Harry is just too good looking.
I don't know. You know, I was looking at this before, and surprisingly, Carson Wentz is right on. But, you know, Prince Harry is not far.
It's not bad.
You know, you take off the beard, and I think it throws it either
way. It throws it away.
Okay, so you get a chance to go hunting at King Ranch, and what's your animal of choice?
I shot a javelina because I didn't feel like I was up to shooting anything else, and so I have a javelina head hanging in the golf course.
So,
it's our trophy.
Of all your options, you went to...
You know, to be honest, I'd never seen a javelina, and on the wall, it looked like a fierce wolverine-killing machine. On the road before I shot it, it looked very docile, and I was deeply regretting my decision. Nonetheless, the mount looks very fierce, and we have a golf tournament that happens to be called the Javelina Cup, and so it is the trophy for our course.
All right. So if you weren't energy, what would you be doing? What's
probably
your dream job?
University professor.
Okay, I like that. So dual citizenship, eh? do you know more facts about U.S. or Canada? Let's see. Who was the first to declare war on Japan in 1941?
In 1941? I'm going to go with the U.S., but I'm probably wrong. I feel like
so that was the year of Pearl Harbor, so that would make sense. But actually, Canada.
It was Canada declared before the
yes,
U.S.?
Yes, can you believe that?
Yeah, well, it's because we knew the U.S. would come to our rescue. I always say the Canadian military is like three canoes and a couple of paddles. And the reason every Canadian is so good at drinking is because if we get in a fight, we're going to lose. So we just try and make people friends of ours at the bar. So that's how that works. But I would say I'm equally a dual citizen. I love Canada. I love the U.S.
Your kids dual citizens?
My kids are dual. My son moved when he was 6 months old, and he still feels very connected to Calgary this year in the playoffs. The Avs played the Flames. I was the only one in our family cheering for the Avs, and my son didn't talk to me for 6 days.
Okay, so do you know the total number of U.S. presidents or Canadian prime ministers?
So 45, I think, is the U.S. one number, right?
Ding, ding.
Because they announce it. Canada, I'd guess it's like 25, but I don't know.
23, close, but it looks like you're more U.S. there. Okay, can you name the highest mountain peak in either Canada or U.S.?
I'm going to sound stupid, so I don't know.
Is it
Mauna Kea?
Mount Logan in Canada and Denali in the U.S.
Oh.
Okay, which country consumes more macaroni and cheese?
I gotta say, it's gotta be the U.S.
Canada.
Really?
I mean, facts I got off the Google. They have to be true.
There's 10 times the
population. They have to be true. I don't
know. Mac and cheese is pretty good.
Do Canadians or Americans own Mall of America?
I'm gonna go with Canadians.
Yeah, Canadians do. Can
you
believe that? Our treasure.
I can't believe it. The treasure.
Okay, so we'll say you're more U.S. there. We'll see. Okay, so how do you unwind and relax?
Netflix.
Okay, we're gonna get there later, but I'll hold off there. If you could have dinner with anyone dead or alive, who would it be?
I think Bill Gates.
Bill Gates. Okay,
yeah,
interesting. Do you love the movie Strange Brew?
I don't love the movie Strange Brew, but I do love the movie Fubar.
Okay, so I've never seen Fubar,
it's
but
like
I love Strange Brew.
Wicked crazy Canadian independent movie. And it's
can I find that out there?
I think it would even be hard. It was like literally some guys like The Hot Take that just filmed a movie that was just the most ridiculous Canadian movie ever, and it was like a little cult movie. So Fubar is pretty quality for Canadian movies as they go.
I pretty much asked that question of anyone I meet from Canada. It's like, do you like the movie Strange Brew? Because
I love The Tragically Hip, obviously. Bare Naked Ladies, great band. I don't claim Justin Bieber.
Drake?
I don't claim Drake.
Okay, so...
I don't know that he knows, but Drake, you are not in the NBA. Stop high-fiving people like you are.
Okay, if what movie can you watch over and over again and not get tired of it?
Two. Big Short, obviously, favorite movie of all time, and Gladiator.
Okay, Gladiator, yeah. Okay, what music are you listening to in your car?
I'm a huge Mumford & Sons guy. I think most people think I don't have any other music on there, and if I pivot from there, it's usually musicals, Miss Saigon or Hamilton.
Ooh, musicals, never would have guessed. What about Nathaniel Rateliff and the Night Sweats?
He's from Denver? Yeah, I know. I can't get into it. Okay. One Republic, I'll give a little props for Denver side, but okay. But Mumford's my main band.
Okay, top three Canadian sports no one appreciates.
Ooh, I mean, you got number one.
You said squash earlier.
And it's more international. I'm gonna 100%. It's got to be curling.
Oh, you know that's.
And I think actually curling is 1, 2, and 3 because any sport that like encourages drinking, smoking, yelling at your teammates, and like gliding on ice with shoes and brooms is like amazing. If you haven't curled, it seriously is wicked fun. So I'm gonna go curling 1, 2, and 3 Canadian underappreciated sports.
Okay, well I will say so. I have actually curled. There's a place you can do it in Houston.
Oh, I love it.
And me and my neighbor did it. Ton of fun. It's so fun. It's ridiculous. It's so much fun.
Yeah, shuffleboard on ice.
But it's so hard to find anywhere you can do it because basically there's not a lot of hockey rinks here.
Yeah.
One, and so to get time to curl on a hockey rink, you're literally doing it like Saturday at 9 o'clock. Or Sunday at like 10 a.m.
Yeah.
But it was a lot of fun when we did it. And I can't believe that's an Olympic sport, but golf is not.
I think golf is now, and then squash is not. Okay. Which squash is, you know, I grew up playing, and it's an awesome sport if you haven't played.
Okay. If you could pick the career or profession for your kids, what would it be and why?
Something they love. And I'm going to make sure that they're grounded the whole time and that they don't focus on their career. So I don't care if they're artists, bakers. I don't care if they live at home. I just want them to be happy. And so honestly, do something you love. I will say I love oil and gas. I love it with all of my soul, and I always have. So I get to do my hobby every day. So when people say, are you ever going to retire? I just don't think so. I want that for my kids. I want that for everybody out there.
Man, you know, I agree there. I definitely... I love with a passion what I do. Public accounting, something about it just gets me going. But I think it's easier to say that, like, when you know your kids will have some financial stability.
100%.
You know, right? Yeah, yeah, yeah. Like, because when when coming up maybe a little broker, you're like, you know what? They need to be able to afford.
Yeah. No, 100%. And I will say, and I've posted on LinkedIn on this too, I think college education in the United States – anywhere but $70,000 a year to go to college is absolutely friggin' ridiculous. You cannot come out of school with a $280,000 debt after tax, which is more like the equivalent of like $430,000 before tax. There are no jobs that are going to do that. I've told my kids that whatever school they get, if it's the University of Buffalo in Ithaca at Chattanooga, and they get a scholarship and they can do that for cheap, that's where they're going. And they're taking a degree that they can get a job in. And if they ain't going to do that, they're going to get right out of school and go working. So, yes, they have some financial security, but this whole concept that like you can graduate with a college degree and it makes life better, let's be honest, it was just a differentiator that allowed the elite to like call out the not elite so people could stay where they are. And at $280,000 a year, it is the worst investment I can possibly imagine, and I tell my kids that every day.
Okay, what is your most useless talent?
I can put half a Coke can in my mouth. Not only do I speak a lot, but I have a very large physical mouth.
How did you figure that out?
I was carrying beer for some friends, and I had 3 beer cans, and I couldn't figure out to stack them, so I put one in each hand, one in my mouth. And I was like, wow, that is gigantic. So it's my party trick. I almost went on Letterman when I was younger about the fact I could almost swallow an entire beer can.
I love it. So you said Netflix, you're into it. Okay, so what TV shows are you binging these days?
So I've been watching Dirty Money, which is a Netflix series, and it's sort of around capitalism gone awry, and there's some phenomenal episodes. And that was on the back of me watching Inside Bill's Brain, which is the last couple of hot take series have kind of been related to some of the work he's been doing specifically on nuclear power. I thought that was fantastic. He's tried to wipe out polio, and he's working on clean sanitation in third world countries. I think it's a wonderful example of what happens when capitalism works and when that person gives back to society in a more efficient way than government. So I'm a big fan of Bill Gates, and I think it's worth watching if you haven't seen it.
All those are really smart studios. I need to know the dirty show. You know, the show that's like not good. Yeah. You know, the show that's like does not infill
the brain. I got to tell you, the family, although people would say, like, are your kids too young? So we watched Game of Thrones together,
okay,
which was pretty great spectacular. Yeah. And I must admit that during the winter season, The Bachelor, where like the 25 women go crazy over the one dude, my kids like just love this. And so we will watch it as a family. And there's a lot of really good parental moments during that.
I don't know what it is, but you know, Brandon had some romantic TV shows too, there, reality shows. So okay, so one energy team's into that. I'm digging it. Okay, so would you rather skydive or run with the bulls
in Spain? Oh, I'd like neither.
Have you done either?
I know. I'm like the most risk averse person. That's the reason I golf. It's about the most impact I want to have these days. If I had to choose, I'd probably do the bulls, because I feel like I'm more in control. I don't know that I want to trust a parachute jumping out of a plane.
Okay, well, 2021, my 40th, we're running with the bulls. If you're in.
There you go.
Any podcast you're into? What do you recommend if you had to recommend too?
Yeah, I mean, obviously excluding the oil and gas ones, this one included. I just think it's great for our industry to now have content, and we got to keep it up. So thank you, and thanks for having me. But I listen to The Daily all the time from the New York Times. I think it's so much better than news to take a story and then they present facts and you can sort of analyze. So I listen to The Daily every day. I listen to How I Built This from NPR. I listen to TED Radio Hour from NPR. And then there's Spittin' Chiclets, which is a hockey-centric one. And these guys are – you only have to listen to the first 5 minutes, but like if you want to know what it's like to be in a locker room with some guys, that's the one.
Okay. Any trip in the world or any city that you could go visit, where would you go?
I really want to go to Pebble Beach. I want to take my family to Pebble Beach. That's overdue. And Dad, if you're listening, we are going to do that before too long.
So you've never been to Carmel or?
Haven't.
Man, yeah, it's beautiful. I've only been for a buddy's wedding, but yeah, it's I never played there, but I'm a horrible golfer. Who in the industry do you respect the most?
So it's not someone I know super well. We've had drinks together, Sky Calentine with, Felix. I think when he did what he and his team, in fairness, but what Felix One did in 2015 when the market first crashed. And I think that the asset they've built in the Delaware is super impressive. And he's done that in generally down markets. So the way he thinks about the world and the way he problem solves is super impressive. You know, I'm very proud of what we did at One Energy, and I'm very proud of what we are doing at Franklin Mountain. I think the team and the people that we have are top drawers. So, you know, I include myself in that, but it's actually the other people that really made it work. So, you know. If I can, I get to work with my heroes every day, so that's pretty fun.
Well, maybe this is a follow-up here. Listener question, this is also came in from a friend. How much smarter has working with Brandon White made you?
Yeah, I mean, I say this all the time. Brandon is like my, he's my work husband, which we both know what that makes me. But his savvy, the way he thinks about the market, the way he deals, his work ethic is like second to none. And I like to think that with what I bring on the technical side, I help balance him out. I just love him, and he makes me smarter. And the reason I can write the hot takes and that like all the segments, finance and technical, can kind of, I sound like not a super idiot. Brandon's a big part of that. I feel very blessed to have got to work with him.
Okay, final one. Who should we interview next?
You know, so if... The person
I'm not saying we're gonna get him, yeah. But if we could,
You know, to me, Vicky Holub, and I know that that's a big ask because she's a public company CEO, and it's hard to kind of do what I just did and be a little bit more candid. But you know, I've written about this on LinkedIn. I think what she did was so exemplary of what a CEO needs to do. She thought the business needed to do something, and she did it. Now, whether it works or whether it doesn't, she owns the legacy, and Carl Icahn clearly thinks she's wrong and she clearly thinks she's right. But I think that she's a fascinating person, and I want to see her succeed. If she can dig out from a 4.5 times debt to EBITDA and make this thing work, I mean, she is going to Jack Welch this thing, like write to books and CNBC and schools. And so she's someone I want to meet. And I think if you could get her, she'd be the one.
So you think if you keep on pressing, you'll get a chance to meet her? One day you're going to get a DM from her assistant.
I've sent her an email. I haven't heard back yet, but I wasn't working that hard. I tried to connect to her on LinkedIn. She hasn't quite connected to me. One day I'm just going to Bud Fox this thing and go sit in the lobby with some cigars on her birthday and like Wall Street this thing right out. And she's going to have to deal with me. So, one day, Vicky, I'm coming for you.
Okay. Well, appreciate your time. That was great. Also, you're going to speak at some of our energy conferences this year, so we're really appreciative of that. And if you ever need anything, let us know.
Yeah, and we loved what Willie Penn did for One Energy. It was absolutely instrumental, and very thankful for our friendship, and I appreciate you having me on. So thank you.